Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California at San Francisco. Dr. Bibbins-Domingo is a member of the National Academy of Medicine, where she recently chaired a panel on social determinants of health and issued a comprehensive report on how to address social determinants in healthcare. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo from UCSF here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California at San Francisco. She is also inaugural vice dean of population health and health equity and is the co-founder of the UCSF Center for Vulnerable Populations at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. Dr. Bibbins-Domingo is also a member of the National Academy of Medicine, where she recently chaired a panel on social determinants of health. She earned her BS in biochemistry at Princeton, completed her PhD in biochemistry, her medical degree, and residency at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Kirsten, we really just admire all of the work that you have done. You recently chaired a panel at the National Academy of Medicine on how best to address the social determinants of health. And I think most of our listeners know the importance that social determinants play in terms of housing and food and transportation and its impact on their health outcomes. And your committee drafted a report, Integrating Social Care into the Delivery of Healthcare, Moving Upstream to Improve the Nation's Health. This is a really wonderful report. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the impact of social determinants and how this report offers a roadmap for addressing them.
As you said, we know that social factors are important for health. Where we live, where we work, what we eat, it all determines our behaviors that relate to our health. Mm-hmm. And the report lays out the way in which the healthcare organizations can think about integrating social care into the delivery of healthcare, as well as the components that need to be in place in order to do that most effectively. We describe two types of activities that really relate to how social needs can be addressed for individual patients. A healthcare delivery system might provide assistance. So if they have problems getting to an appointment, to provide vouchers for transportation, maybe using telehealth to avoid transportation mm-hmm. needs. So some of these things are not just doing things one patient at a time, mm-hmm. but rather also aligning with community organizations in both alignment and advocacy activities to really change policies and other structures within the communities that might systematically address needs within a community.
You know, I think it's clear that in the community health center world, perhaps the VA world, a number of systems, there's always been a keen awareness of the social determinants, right? And then we moved from, and we ought to do something about them in healthcare, to we really need to do them. And then, of course, the specter of, and how do we pay for doing this? Because, in fact, it calls upon the skill sets of often other members of the team mm-hmm. than the ones who we are used to paying for. In this domain, we've really seen quite a bit of change in progress in a yeah. relatively short period of time. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what you're seeing as the trend, not just in the safety net settings of community health centers in the VA
yes.
and all throughout the healthcare system, and health plans are beginning to look at how they might incentivize or pay for this. So tell us a little bit about what you're seeing as major trends there.
Yeah, I think this is really important. A key for this report was starting out with the fact that, you know, we're spending a lot of money for healthcare and we're not quite achieving the outcomes we'd like to achieve. And many of the trends in healthcare are shifting from volume to value, right? So
right.
I'm a general internist. I always want to provide the best care for my patients, but I get paid every time they come in to see me, I get paid every time they're in the hospital. Shifting to value is, you know, could I be incentivized to make sure that I have my diabetics as best controlled as they can possibly be and actually avoid a hospitalization? And I think that shift from volume to value forces healthcare delivery systems to think a little bit outside the box. So in my example for diabetics, if we're not achieving the outcomes, do I need to understand whether a patient can pick up their medications? Do they have a pharmacist that's close by? Can they store their insulin in a refrigerator or are they homeless? Do they actually have access to healthy foods? If I understand that context, which is important for achieving good outcomes in diabetes, that then aligns incentives to thinking about all of those factors that might be important for helping my diabetic patients to have the best control possible.
I want to sort of pull the thread. I want to talk a little bit about the leadership within healthcare organizations that are required. And certainly we've organized ourselves around team-based care. We have the pods. And in the pods, we might have a community health worker, an MA, certainly a nurse, nurse practitioner, whole range of people who are coming there. So it really requires a reconceptualization. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that role of leadership and maybe give some guidance and some helpful hints for those who are listening about how you take on this role.
So while we emphasize over and over again in this report how important it is for all members of a healthcare team to be aware of how social factors influence health, there are members of our workforce who are really expert in addressing social needs. Like social workers historically have really been at the forefront of this, but also community health workers, gerontologists, other people who might whose expertise is really in addressing those social factors, really thinking about our interprofessional teams. You describe in community health centers in the VA that this has really been woven into the fabric of the way healthcare is delivered there, but it really has to happen in other settings as well. So while we're moving from volume to value, it does mean that a recognition that this workforce also needs to be considered essential for healthcare delivery and be eligible for reimbursement in many cases for the systems that still exist. Mm-hmm. There needs to be sort of the leadership to think about us as teams, as we train as teams, and as we think about the teams together. And I think that we're in a shifting landscape for how we pay for this all. But I think leaders in healthcare delivery really need to be articulating this as the vision of where we're going and then putting these other things in place so that we can get there effectively.
Well, Kirsten, back in 2007, I understand you founded the Center for Vulnerable Populations at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, where you focus on the special among the special, people with complex comorbidities and where the line between social, biological, behavioral, because these patients require much more focused care coordination, or as our leaders in that program like to say, the kind of really great healthcare anybody would like to get because you're thinking all the services. But in having that center to address the needs of these patients, what have you learned about health outcomes and the difference that all of this makes?
The term vulnerable populations is a little bit, can be controversial, and it doesn't capture fully that individuals also have extraordinary resiliencies.
Absolutely.
To deal with adversity. Thinking about how multiple vulnerabilities together create the types of challenges that need to be addressed, not just what happens in the context of healthcare, but also how they are in the community. So our center is a research center. It's currently directed by Margaret Cushell. I think many of the faculty in the Center for Vulnerable Populations focus on specific high needs populations. Dr. Cushell herself focuses on homeless populations and really understanding as our homeless populations in the Bay Area are aging, their healthcare needs, and particularly magnified by lack of housing. We have faculty who focus on food and addressing food insecurity. And then we're very interested in technology. We think that just because we are working in a safety net setting, a lot of times our high-tech solutions actually can allow us to reach more people if they are done with a partnership with the communities we aim to serve. And so we're mostly focused on research and trying to be at the leading edge for implementing strategies in clinical settings, in community-based settings, as well as in the policy arena that can allow us to improve the health of our most vulnerable in our area and nationally.
We're speaking today with Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of San Francisco, and is co-founder of the UCSF Center for Vulnerable Populations at San Francisco General Hospital. Kirsten, let's talk a little bit about this recalibration of the health system to do a better job in focusing on prevention. You're a biochemist, researcher, and a clinician, and you're also a big believer in the promise of precision medicine. I should note that our health center was chosen by the National Institute of Health to be an early participant in the All of Us study, making sure we have a population in that study that represents all of us. And you've been very focused in on diversifying genetic studies. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of the important research in cardiovascular health, for example, and how precision medicine techniques are helping you mine that data.
Great question. We live in a really extraordinary time where we can know so much more about those biological factors that put us at risk for disease. When we combine that information with things that we know about our individual behaviors over time and the environments that we live in, of pulling all these strands of data together with the computational power that allows us now to analyze that data, that can really yield new insights for individual patients, but also for groups and communities of patients. Sometimes it's hard to know what terms precision medicine mean, sure. But they mean to me more data that we can thread together in a way with other types of data to really understand how to best target both prevention and treatments for an individual. In cardiovascular disease prevention, one of the things that animates me in particular is how we start to do prevention earlier in life, mm-hmm. that we're not just waiting when somebody is 50 to say, oh yeah, take your blood pressure medicines, but think, what could we be doing at the earliest possible stages? How do we identify those fewer people amongst our adolescents and young adults who may be at very high risk? And I think there's a lot of promise for the types of efforts in the All of Us initiative, in the Precision Medicine initiative, to really, in the cardiovascular disease space, help us say we have to prevent at all stages in life, but those people who are at high risk at early ages, we want to really double down and make sure that we are aggressive in treating the types of risk factors as they develop. I also think there is potential there to reach populations we've not always reached. That's why I'm really thrilled that All of Us has made such a concerted effort to increase the diversity. Mm-hmm. We know if we just talk about genetic factors that determine outcomes, most of our genome-wide association studies and our genomic studies are disturbingly lacking in diverse representation.
I think
4% in our genomic studies, 4% represent African American, Asian, or Latino populations, which is really just unacceptable.
Yes.
It's also because the insights we get in biology come from understanding the heterogeneity that exists. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually important for all of us mm-hmm. to have diverse participation in all of these studies. Mm-hmm. Right now, we live in an environment where data can be integrated in ways that I actually think we can deliver care better in this way. So we've used this term precision population health or precision public health, which basically says a lot of what we're talking about in integrating social care and healthcare is like, well, can we use our healthcare data to understand hotspots in the community for diabetes in poor control and understand what is it in that environment? In the report, we describe efforts to use in Louisville that people were using real-time, real data on their use of inhalers to understand environmental factors in a particular area and advocate. And so I think there's lots of innovative ways we can use real-time data from individuals to improve individual health in the Precision Medicine Initiative, but also population health.
Well, that's wonderful. And I think you would be very moved to see the wide range of people of all kinds of backgrounds, ethnicities that mm-hmm. are enrolling in the study. It's very powerful, exactly what Francis Collins set out to do. But I want to give you a chance to talk about something that I know you're very passionate about, and that is our work to train the next generation of healthcare providers and researchers and healthcare providers who are researchers, which we think is really a sweet spot. You're at one of the country's best teaching hospitals, University of California at San Francisco. So as you think about this work that you're doing to really reshape the American healthcare system, How are you looking at training this next generation in a different way?
One of the things that I think has been extraordinary at UCSF is really how much what we are talking about here today, social care and healthcare, has really been front and center with how our medical school curriculum is designed. The first weeks of medical school, our medical students are not in the classroom, but they're actually out in the community and community organizations to really understand the communities in our area. So it's really woven in. We listen to our students. We have a diverse student body. And 3 years ago, when they were protesting Black Lives Matter, they started the movement White Coats for Black Lives. And a lot of the activism amongst our students actually is reflected in the changes in the curriculum, in the way that we weave together social determinants of health, structural factors that impede good health, as well as health care. My goal, I want all students to be inquirers. That's really key in our curriculum.
Absolutely.
And we want some subset of those students to actually pursue research careers,
yeah.
Right? I think we were really fortunate at when I was first starting, and then in 2006 when we founded the center, that there were people on our campus who basically said that we want to be a full service research organization. And so training the next generation to be outstanding clinicians is important, but also that they become the people who are leading the scholarship in this area, mm-hmm. as well. Training in this area is going to be important for all of us. Mm-hmm. It's not just an awareness of social determinants of health, but also skill building. You all talk about these really powerful interprofessional teams. Turns out it's actually hard to work in interprofessional teams. And to the extent we can train earlier, mm-hmm. on how to do that effectively, that really allows us to build a workforce that's not just aware, but actually has the skills to do this. And then we've talked a little bit about this extraordinary data-rich environment that we live in. I want those clinicians who are interested in this area, who think about data science, to actually think about how can they apply those data science tools to ways to think about data integration across the many sectors that we're talking about. That's where the next wave of discovery and innovation, mm-hmm. is going to come.
You know, I want to bring the P word into our conversation, not politics, but policy. And a good health policy was certainly the Affordable Care Act. But I think you come from an interesting perspective as a clinician, a physician leader, and I know you've been very focused in on the great disparities of health outcomes that have occurred because really we haven't made good policy. It hasn't been informed by data. Talk to us a little bit about some health policy initiatives that make sense to you.
This is such an important question. I think the voice of physicians, the voice of researchers, to be able to speak and advocate directly with policymakers is critically important. You know, I work mostly with researchers, and we always want to have that objective lens as researchers and separate it from advocacy. But I think being able to disseminate our findings and work closely with policymakers so that they can develop evidence-based policy is critical. We've started a new homelessness initiative that has at its core taking the evidence base and working directly with policymakers so that they can make more informed policy choices that we know impact the health of the patients that we care the most about. We have a special initiative that we are launching at UCSF, which we call Evidence to Impact, which is basically how can we get researchers, clinicians, to be able to speak on evidence directly with policymakers and partner, great. With them for change in HIV, in tobacco, in food policies. When you talk about the national landscape and you ask me what's going to be most important for disparities, one is the extraordinary progress that has been made in just achieving more access to care, mm-hmm. Because people have insurance coverage. Mm-hmm. And I think while we talk about the social determinants of health and they are critical, access to high quality healthcare is also critical. And mm-hmm. I think in the report, we do talk about the financing models that are really necessary to achieve integration, mm-hmm. of social care into the delivery of healthcare. Even within our current structures, we could try many more things, mm-hmm. and that much more innovation is possible. And I think we always want to be in a policy environment that allows those of us on the ground practicing to try the things that we know is going to be best for our patients. There's so many ways in which the policy environment can really help us to develop our own solutions. And I think we're really encouraged by that.
Well, we've been speaking today with Dr. Kirsten Bibbins Domingo, professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF and a member of the National Academy of Medicine, where she has just chaired the panel on social determinants of health. You can access their report at thenationalacademies.org/socialcare or follow her work by going to ucsf.edu/Kirsten.Bibbins-Domingo. Kirsten, we want to thank you so much for your leadership, your dedication to research and to practice, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke has faced backlash from Republicans and some Democrats for his advocacy of a mandatory buyback program for so-called assault weapons. But Senator Chuck Schumer went too far when he said he didn't know of any other Democrats who agree with O'Rourke. There are at least two Democratic senators running for president who agree with O'Rourke's proposal. All of the leading Democratic presidential candidates support a ban on the sale of certain semi-automatic weapons, but most of the candidates have expressed a preference for either a mandatory or voluntary buyback of such weapons currently owned by Americans. Senator Kamala Harris told reporters in New Hampshire that she supports a mandatory buyback program. Senator Cory Booker also supports such a proposal. One other candidate, Julian Castro, said he at least supports a voluntary buyback program, but, quote, I'm willing to hear the arguments on mandatory. The NRA says the AR-15 is, quote, America's most popular rifle. That rifle was used in several mass shootings, including at schools in Newtown, Connecticut, and Parkland, Florida. Estimates on the number of privately owned assault weapons range from 3.3 million to 16 million. As for the public, an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found 46% said Congress should pass legislation to, quote, create a mandatory buyback program of assault guns. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Louisville, Kentucky has consistently been on a top 20 list of U.S. cities you don't want to live in if you have a lung disorder. Surrounded by the nation's leading rubber manufacturing entities, this is a city that has grappled with pollution. Several years ago, the city's newly hired chief of innovation made a decision to tackle the issue.
Maybe the risk is concentrated in certain places. And if we knew where the risk was concentrated, maybe there would be something we could do about it.
Ted Smith had learned of a tech-enabled smart inhaler that, when synced to a person's phone, acted like a GPS for whenever that person needed to use their rescue inhalers.
To put a GPS transponder on top of your inhaled medication so that when you took a puff of your medication, it would take a snapshot of what time it was and where you were. And you're capturing it in real time.
Smith dubbed the program Air Louisville and tracked 1,100 participants over the course of a year. He said they were able to chart environmental triggers in any given area where an asthma attack occurred, giving them some great public health epidemiology data.
One part of the use of the technology is the surveillance, but another part of the technology is the feedback loop to the user who learns how poorly controlled or not their asthma is. And there is an immediate effect. People end up getting better control of their respiratory disease.
Reliance on emergency inhalers dropped 78% among participants, and the city was now armed with data that could help them devise pollution mitigation strategies.
We have the harder problem. People are exposed to levels of pollution that we are going to have to work hard to figure out how to remove.
A tech-enabled smart inhaler that informs public health officials how they might reduce the burden of asthma health costs while teaching asthma sufferers to better control their disease and stay healthier. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.